The paved parking lot at the pier in Lesbos was full of the kinds of camping tents sold in sporting goods stores, round-topped single-family tents of blue and green and white and yellow and red, all provided by Greek relief workers who knew the refugees had nowhere to stay while they waited for the ferry to Athens to come. Wet clothes were hung out to dry on bicycle racks and traffic signs, and refugees gathered around camp stoves and hot plates. It should have been a lively place, full of songs and laughter, like the Kilis refugee camp. But instead, a soft, mournful murmur of conversation hung over the tent city like a fog. Mahmoud wasn't surprised. His family felt exactly the same way. They all should have been excited to finally be in Greece, to be allowed to buy real tickets to travel on an actual ferry to mainland Europe. But too many of them had lost someone in the sea crossing to be happy. Mahmoud's mother had gone from tent to tent asking after Hana. Mahmoud had helped. It was his fault she was gone after all. But no one at the dock had her, and no one had been on the dinghy that had taken her. Refugees came and went, but the tents remained, and Mahmoud's mother insisted they miss the next ferry to Athens so she could ask each new round of refugees for word of her daughter. But no one knew anything about her. Mahmoud felt as sick as he had on the dinghy. He couldn't look at his mother. She had to blame him for losing Hana. He certainly blamed himself. He couldn't sleep at night. He kept picturing his sister's dinghy bursting on the rocks, Hana falling into the water, none of them there to help her. Mahmoud's mother wanted to stay at the dock longer, didn't want to leave without knowing what happened to Hana, but Dad told her they had to move on. There was no telling when the ferry line might suddenly decide to stop selling tickets to refugees, or when Greece might decide to send them all home. They had to keep moving, or they would die. Hana had to have gone ahead of them on the morning ferry they'd missed that first day. Or else... no one wanted to think about the or else. The huge Athens ferry arrived again that morning. It was the length of a soccer field, and at least 5 stories tall. The bottom half of it was painted blue, and Blue Star Ferries was written in big words on the side. A radar bar spun near the bridge, and antennas and satellite dishes sprouted from the roof. It looked like the pictures Mahmoud had seen of cruise ships. Its lifeboats alone were bigger than the dinghy they had left Turkey in. Mahmoud tried to get Walid interested in the big ship, to get him excited about their first trip on a boat that big. But his little brother didn't care. He didn't seem to care about anything. A big ramp on the back lowered, and refugees streamed on board the ferry. Mahmoud's mother wept as they climbed the ramp with the other passengers. She kept looking back over her shoulder at the tent city, hoping, Mahmoud was sure, to catch a glimpse of someone carrying a baby who might be Hana. But she never did. The inside of the ferry was like the lobby of a fancy hotel. Every floor had little clusters of glass tables and white upholstered chairs. Snack bars sold chips and sweets and sodas, and televisions played a Greek soccer game. Refugees who still had belongings stuffed their backpacks and trash bags under the tables and into the overhead compartments. Mahmoud and his family settled into one of the booths, and his father searched for a plug to charge his phone.
"Mahmoud, why don't you take your brother and explore the ship?" Dad told him.
Mahmoud was only too glad to get away from the sight of his mother's broken face, and he took Walid by the hand and pulled him out onto the promenade that ran around the outside of the ship. Mahmoud and Walid watched silently as the ferry pulled away from the dock, the ship's huge engines thrumming deep below them. The awful sea that had tried to swallow them was calm and sapphire blue now. The Greek island of Lesbos was actually beautiful when you saw it from the sea. Little white buildings with terracotta roofs rose up tree-covered hills, and on top of one of the hills was an ancient gray castle. Mahmoud could see why people visited there on vacation. Besides the refugees, there were a number of tourists on board. Mahmoud could tell they weren't refugees because they wore clean clothes and used their phones for taking pictures instead of looking up overland routes from Athens to Macedonia. Another refugee had laid out a mat on the deck, and he was praying. In all the bustle of waiting in line and getting on board, Mahmoud had lost track of what time it was, and he pulled his brother down with him to pray alongside the man. As he kneeled and stood, Mahmoud was supposed to be focused only on his prayers. But he couldn't help notice the uneasy looks the tourists were giving them, the frowns of displeasure, like Mahmoud and his brother and this man were doing something wrong. The vacationers dropped their voices, and even though Mahmoud couldn't understand what they were saying, he could hear the disgust in their words. This wasn't what the tourists had paid for. They were supposed to be on holiday, seeing ancient ruins and beautiful Greek beaches, not stepping over filthy, praying refugees. "They only see us when we do something they don't want us to do," Mahmoud realized. The thought hit him like a lightning bolt. When they stayed where they were supposed to be, in the ruins of Aleppo or behind the fences of a refugee camp, people could forget about them. But when refugees did something they didn't want them to do, when they tried to cross the border into their country or slept on the front stoops of their shops or jumped in front of their cars or prayed on the decks of their ferries, that's when people couldn't ignore them any longer. Mahmoud's first instinct was to disappear below decks, to be invisible. Being invisible in Syria had kept him alive. But now Mahmoud began to wonder if being invisible in Europe might be the death of him and his family. If no one saw them, no one could help them. And maybe the world needed to see what was really happening here. It was hard not to see the refugees in Athens when Mahmoud got there. Syrians were everywhere, in the streets and hotels and markets, most of them, like Mahmoud's family, planning to move on as soon as they could. Mahmoud's father thought he had the right documents to travel freely in Greece, but a woman at an immigration office told him he would need to go to a local police station first to get an official document, and the police told him he would have to wait up to a week. "We can't wait a week," Mahmoud's father told his family. They had found a hotel for 10 euros a night per person, and the people of Athens were very friendly and helpful. But Mahmoud knew his parents only had so much money, and they still had 4 more countries to cross before they reached Germany. Mahmoud's mother would have stayed a week or even longer to keep asking everyone she met if they had seen a baby named Hana. But it was decided. They would take a train to the border of Macedonia and try to sneak across during the night.
Joseph. Just outside Havana Harbor, 1939. 21 days from home. Joseph watched from the deck as another little boat snuck through the flotilla of reporters and fruit sellers and Cuban policemen surrounding the MS St. Louis. This boat held a familiar-looking passenger, and Joseph realized with a start that it was Dr. Aber, Renata and Evelina's father, who already lived in Cuba. Joseph ran through the ship until he found the sisters in the movie theater watching serials. "Your dad's coming to the ship," Joseph told them. Renata and Evelina hurried after him. When they got back to the ladder at C deck, they got an even bigger surprise. Dr. Aber had gotten on board the St. Louis. Officer Padron was looking over some papers Dr. Aber had brought with him, and a small crowd had gathered to see what was happening. Renata and Evelina ran to their father, and he swept them up in his arms. "My beautiful daughters," he said, kissing them both. "I thought I'd never see you again." Officer Padron nodded and said something in Spanish to Dr. Aber, and Dr. Aber smiled at his daughters. "Come, it's time for you to join me in Cuba."
"But what about our things, our clothes?" Renata asked.
"Forget about them. We'll buy you new clothes in Cuba," Dr. Aber said. His eyes darted to the policeman, and Joseph understood. Somehow, Dr. Aber had gotten someone official to let him come get his daughters off the ship, but he didn't want to wait around any longer in case the policemen changed their minds. He carried Renata and Evelina to the ladder, and Renata barely had time to yell goodbye to Joseph and wave before they were gone over the side. Joseph was speechless, but the rest of the crowd wasn't. Angry passengers surrounded Officer Padron and the other policemen, demanding answers.
How come they got off the ship and not us?
Can you help us?
How do they do it?
Let us off the ship. My husband is in Cuba.
They have papers, right papers,
Officer Padron tried to explain in broken German, but that only made the crowd madder.
We have papers, visas.
We paid for them.
Joseph was scared for Officer Padron, but he shared the passenger's frustration. Why had Dr. Auber been able to take Renata and Develina off, and none of the rest of them could go? It wasn't fair. Joseph clenched his fists and began to shake. Then he realized it wasn't him that was doing the shaking. It was the metal deck of the ship. The ship's engines were rumbling to life for the first time since they had dropped anchor, which could mean only one thing. The St. Louis was going home to Germany, and they were all going with it. Without a word from anyone, the passengers rushed the top of the ladder as one. Officer Padron drew his pistol, and Joseph gasped.
Pardon!
The policeman cried.
Halt!
He swept the gun back and forth, and the other policemen drew their pistols and did the same. The angry passengers pulled back, but didn't run away. Joseph's heart was in his throat. Any second now, the mob was going to attack the policemen. Joseph knew it. They would rather die than be sent back to Germany. Back to Hitler. The ship's first officer and the purser arrived and threw themselves in between the guards and the angry crowd. They begged for everyone to remain calm, but no one listened. As the vibrations of the ship's engines below grew louder and more insistent, more people rushed to the ladder to demand to be let off the ship. Joseph was caught in the middle now. If the mob pushed forward into the guns of the policemen, Joseph would have no choice but to push with them. It was hot, well over 100 degrees on deck already, and the temperature of the crowd was rising. Joseph was a ball of sweat, and the close-packed mob only made things worse. The situation was just about to boil over when a small white man in a gray suit climbed up the ladder behind the policeman. It was Captain Schroeder. But Joseph wondered why he was out of uniform, and why had he been off the ship? For a moment, the mob was so surprised it stopped surging forward. Captain Schroeder was surprised, too. As soon as he saw the angry crowd and the guns drawn, he lost his temper. He yelled at the policemen to lower their weapons, or he would order them off the ship, and at last they obeyed.
"Why have the engines started?"
one of the passengers yelled.
"Tell us what's happening!"
Captain Schroeder put his hands in the air and called for calm so that he could explain. He took off his hat and mopped his brow with his handkerchief.
"I have just been to see President Brew, to appeal to him personally for you to be allowed to disembark," the captain said. "But he would not see me."
There were dark mutterings among the passengers, and Joseph felt himself getting angrier. What was going on? Why had the Cubans promised the passengers they would let them in, only to turn them away now?
"Worse," Captain Schroeder said. "The Cuban government has ordered us to leave the harbor by tomorrow morning."
Leave by tomorrow? Joseph thought. And go where? And what about his father? Would he be leaving with them? Cries of anger came from the passengers, and Joseph joined in. The first officer had disappeared briefly, but now returned with more sailors in case there was violence. Joseph wondered if he should bring his mother to hear this news, but he knew she was in their cabin, most likely in bed, crying. She blamed herself for her husband's suicide attempt, and in the last 2 days she had become, in a way, as absent a parent as Joseph's father. No, Joseph was the one who needed to be here right now, for his mother and for Ruthie. Captain Schroeder called for quiet again.
"We are not going home. We will cruise the American coast and make appeals to President Roosevelt. If any of you have friends or family in the States, I beg you to ask them to exert what influence they can. No matter what, I assure you, I will do everything in my power to arrange a landing outside Germany. Hope must always remain. Now, please, go back to your cabins. I must return to the bridge to make the ship ready for our departure."
The crowd mobbed the captain as he tried to leave C deck, the passengers pushing and shoving their way around Joseph. Joseph fought his way to the passenger who had translated for Officer Padron the other day and pulled him to where the policeman stood.
What about my father? Joseph asked Officer Padron through the translator.
I saw him in the hospital, the policeman told Joseph. He's not well enough to come to the ship.
Then can we go to him instead? Joseph asked.
The policeman looked pained.
I'm sorry, little man. You cannot leave the ship.
But the ship is leaving, Joseph said. He could feel the pulsing engines under his feet.
We can't leave my father behind.
I wish from the bottom of my heart that you will land soon, little man, Officer Padron said again. I'm sorry, I'm just doing my job. Joseph looked deep into Officer Padron's eyes, searching for some sign of help, some hint of sympathy. Officer Padron just looked away. Joseph was still standing there in the hot Cuban sun when, right before lunch, the policeman left on a launch. Officer Padron still wouldn't look at him. Once the little boat was clear, the MS St. Louis blew its horn, raised its anchor, and left Havana Harbor, destination unknown. As he stood at the rail with the rest of the passengers, saying a tearful goodbye to the only place that had ever promised them refuge, Joseph said goodbye to his father as well. He took his shirt collar in both hands and ripped it along the seam, rending his garment as he'd done when Professor Weiler had been buried at sea. Joseph knew Papa was still alive, but it didn't matter. His father was dead to his family. And so, Joseph realized, was their dream of joining him in Cuba.
Isabel, somewhere between the Bahamas and Florida, 1994. 5 days from home. The night sky was so clear Isabel could see the Milky Way. Her gaze was on the stars, but she wasn't really looking at them. She wasn't really looking at anything. Her eyes were blurry from tears. Next to her, Señora Castillo sobbed in her husband's arms, her shoulders heaving. Like Isabel, she had been crying ever since Iván died. Señor Castillo stared out over his wife's head, his eyes vacant. Luis kicked out at the silent engine, rattling the bolts that held it down. He buried his face in his hands, and Amara hugged him tight. Iván was dead. Isabel couldn't grasp it. 1 minute he had been alive, talking to them, laughing with them, and the next he was dead. Lifeless. Like every other Cuban who had ever died trying to get to El Norte by sea. But Iván wasn't some nameless, faceless person. He was Iván. Her Iván. He was her friend. And he was dead. Isabel's eyes drifted down to where Iván's body lay, but she still didn't look right at him. Couldn't. Even though Papi had taken down the shirt he draped over Mommy to shade her and laid it across Iván's face, Isabel couldn't bear to look. She knew Iván's face. His smile. She wanted to think of him that way. Lito sang a low, sad song, and Isabel retreated into the arms of her mother and father. The three of them huddled together, as if what happened to Iván might happen to them too if they came too close to his body. But the real threat was the sinking boat and the sharks that still circled it, following the trail of bloody water that started at Isabel's feet. Fidel Castro had Iván's blood all over him. Isabel remembered the wake for her grandmother. It had been a quiet, somber occasion. There hadn't even been a body to bury. Those who had come had spent most of their time comforting Lito and Mommy and Isabel, hugging them and kissing them and sharing their grief. Isabel knew she should do that now for the Castillos, but she couldn't bring herself to do it. How could she comfort the Castillos when she still needed comforting herself? Iván was their son, their brother, but he was Isabel's best friend. In some ways, she knew him better even than his family did. She'd played soccer with him in the alley, swum with him in the sea, sat next to him in school. She had eaten dinner at his house and he at hers so many times they might as well have been brother and sister. Isabel and Iván had grown up together. She couldn't imagine a world where she would run next door and he wouldn't be there. But Ivan wouldn't be coming over anymore. Ivan was dead. The loss of him ached like a part of Isabel was suddenly missing, like her heart had been ripped out of her chest, and all that was left was a giant gaping hole. She shook again as her body was racked with sobs, and Mommy pulled her closer. After a time, Isabel's grandfather finally spoke.
"We need to do something," he said, "with the body."
Señora Castillo wailed, but Señor Castillo nodded. "Do something with the body?" Isabel looked around. But what was there to be done with Ivan's body on this little raft? And then Isabel understood. There was only one place for Ivan's body to go. Into the sea. The thought made her recoil in terror.
"No! No, we can't leave him here!" Isabel cried. "He'll be all alone. Ivan never liked to be alone."
Lito nodded to Isabel's father, and the two of them stood to lift Ivan out of the small boat. Isabel fought to get free of her mother, but Mommy held her tight.
"Wait," Señora Castillo said.
She pulled herself away from her husband, her face streaked with tears.
"We have to say something. A prayer. Something. I want God to know Ivan is coming."
Isabel had never been to church. When Castro and the communists had taken over, they had discouraged the practice of religion. But Spanish Catholics had conquered the island long before Castro had, and Isabel knew their religion was still there, deep down, the way Lito told her clave was buried beneath the audible rhythms of a song. Lito was the oldest, and had been to the most funerals, so he took charge. He made the sign of the cross over Ivan's body and said,
"Eternal rest grant unto him, O Lord, and let perpetual light shine upon him. May he rest in peace. Amen."
Señora Castillo nodded, and Lito and Isabel's father picked up Ivan's body.
"No, no!"
Isabel cried. She reached out as if to stop them, then pulled her hands back and clasped them to her chest. She knew they had to do this, that they could not keep Ivan on the boat with them. Not like this. But as she watched Lito and Papi lift up Ivan's body, the empty place inside got bigger and bigger, until she was more empty than full. She wished she was dead, too. She wished she was dead so they would put her into the water with Ivan, so she could keep him company in the deep. Señora Castillo reached out and took her son's hand one last time, and Luis stood and put a hand to Ivan's chest, one last connection to his brother before he was gone for good. Isabel wanted to do something, to say something, but she was too overcome with grief.
"Wait," Luis said.
He pulled his pistol from his holster. His face turned mean as he aimed it over the other side of the boat, at one of the fins that skimmed the surface. Isabel was ready for the shots this time, but they still made her jump. Bang! 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 The shark died in a bloody thrashing spasm, and the other sharks that had been following the boat fell on it in a frenzy. Luis nodded to Lito and Isabel's father, and Señora Castillo looked away as they slipped Ivan off the other side of the boat, away from the sharks, where he sank into the Black Sea. No one spoke. Isabel cried, the tears coming without end, flowing up from the hollow place in her chest that threatened to consume her. Ivan was gone. Forever. Isabel suddenly remembered Ivan's Industriales cap. Where was it? What had happened to it? It hadn't been on him when he'd been put back in the water, and Isabel wanted to find it. Needed to find it. That was something she could do. A piece of him she could keep close to her. She pulled away from her mother and searched the little boat for it. It had to be somewhere. Yes, there. floating upside down in the bloody water, underneath one of the benches. She plucked it up and held it to her chest, the only part of Iván she had left.
I wanted to open a restaurant,
Señor Castillo said. He was right next to her, and the sound of his voice, almost a whisper, made Isabel jump.
When we were talking that first night, everybody was telling each other what they wanted to do when we got to the U.S.
Señor Castillo went on.
But I never said. I wanted to open a restaurant with my sons.
Something sparkled on the dark horizon, and at first, Isabel took it to be one of the stars in the white scar of the Milky Way twinkling in her watery eyes. But no, it was too bright, too orange, and there were others just like it, all clustered in a horizontal line, separating the black waters from the black sky. It was Miami at last. Iván had just missed seeing Miami.
Mahmoud, Macedonia to Serbia, 2015. 14 to 15 days from home. Mahmoud felt like he was back in Syria. Policemen with guns guarded the border from Greece into Macedonia, and he felt dirty again. Unwanted. Illegal. Even without travel papers, Mahmoud and his family had been able to exchange their Syrian pounds for euros and buy train tickets from Athens to Thessaloniki, and from there to a little Greek town near the border of Macedonia. Now they were headed for the Macedonian town of Gevgelia, where they hoped to catch a train north to Serbia and from there to Hungary. But first, they had to find a way to sneak across the border. Mahmoud pointed out a little tangle of tents and laundry lines just off the gravel road, and Mahmoud's father pulled them into the camp to plan their next move. It was another little refugee village, the kind of makeshift town Mahmoud had seen again and again on the road out of Syria. Mahmoud and his father hunkered down behind a trash barrel and watched the border crossing. The Macedonian police weren't turning people away, but they might be checking papers, and Mahmoud's family hadn't waited in Athens for official travel permits. Mahmoud's dad pulled out his iPhone and consulted the map. This whole area is farmland, his father said. Flatland. Too easy to be caught. He scrolled sideways on the map, and Mahmoud leaned in closer. It looks like there's a forest here, to the west, Dad said. They can't have every meter of the border guarded. We'll slip through at night. Once we're in Macedonia, we'll be all right. Where's your mother? Mahmoud looked up. Mom was where she always was, working her way through the tents, looking for Hannah. Hannah wasn't there, though, and she wasn't at any of the other little clusters of refugee tents they passed as they hiked farther into the countryside. At some place he'd picked from the map on his iPhone, Mahmoud's father led them off a dirt road into a dark forest. It was late, well after midnight, and Mahmoud was weary from walking. But they still had 2 hours to walk to the Macedonian border. Walid raised his arms to be carried, and Dad hefted him up against his shoulder. Mahmoud bristled. Walid was being a baby. He was too big to be carried. Mahmoud was tired too, but nobody was carrying him. They walked along in silence, their way lit only by the occasional glow of the phone screen, as Dad checked their position. The forest was full of tall pine trees that crowded almost everything else out, and the ground was covered with brown pine needles that smelled like a car freshener. Somewhere in the forest, an owl screeched, and Mahmoud heard the scurrying of small animals. Every rustle made Mahmoud jump. Every scuffle gave him goosebumps. He was a city boy, used to the lights and sounds of traffic. Here, every sound was like a gunshot in the unearthly dark and quiet. It terrified Mahmoud. At last they emerged from the dark woods and found the train station. It was a small two-story mustard-colored building with a burgundy roof and rounded gables. It was also packed with people. Hundreds of people slept outside, using their backpacks and trash bags as pillows. They filled the train platform and the sidewalks in front of the station, and some even slept between the tracks. Plastic bottles and empty bags and discarded wrappers littered the ground. Mahmoud watched his father's shoulders sag. Mahmoud felt the same way, but then his father stood taller and hiked Walid up higher on his shoulder. "Hey, at least we know we're on the right track," he said. He grinned at Mahmoud. "The right track. Get it?" Mahmoud got it. He just didn't think any of this was funny. "No, nothing?" his father said. "I guess I need to train you better." Mahmoud still didn't laugh. He was too tired. Mahmoud's mother had already left them, stepping carefully among the sleeping refugees like a ghost, searching for Hana. "The train station looks closed," Mahmoud's father told him. "We'll have to find some place to sleep. We'll come back in the morning and see if we can buy tickets." They found a nearby hotel listed on TripAdvisor, and they collected Mahmoud's mother and set out for the inn on foot. Mahmoud couldn't wait to climb into a real bed. He felt like he could sleep for days. A car came up behind them, and this time Mahmoud didn't jump out in front of it. But it slowed down and stopped beside them anyway. "You need taxi?" the man said in broken Arabic. "No," Mahmoud's father said. "We're just going to the hotel." "Hotel, much money," the man said. "You go to Serbia? I take you in taxi. 25 euros each." Mahmoud did the math. 100 euros was a lot of money, almost 24,000 Syrian pounds. But a taxi ride straight to Serbia without spending the night or longer in Macedonia? Mahmoud's parents huddled together, and Mahmoud listened in. Train tickets were likely cheaper, and Mom worried about accepting a ride from a strange man in a country they didn't know. But Dad argued there wasn't another train until at least tomorrow, and there were already so many people waiting for the train at the station. "We're all tired, and a taxi gets us closer to Germany. Sleeping on the ground doesn't," Mahmoud threw in. "That's the deciding vote then," Dad said. "We'll take the car." It was a good decision. 2 hours and 100 euros later, they were at the Serbian border. It was still dark, but there were no border guards where the driver dropped them off. No roads either. Mahmoud had slept a little in the car, but he felt like a zombie as he shambled with his family along the railroad tracks that would take them across the border from Macedonia to the nearest Serbian town. Since they were traveling, they were permitted to skip their early morning prayers. They staggered into a town just after sunup. Mahmoud thought that if he didn't lie down somewhere and sleep, he would pass out on his feet and fall flat on his face. But there were even more refugees at this train station than there had been in Macedonia, and here there were no tents and no hotel rooms. People slept on the platform of the station or outside in the fields. There were no toilets either, and no markets or restaurants. What little the local Serbs had, they were charging a fortune for. One man was selling water bottles for 5 euros apiece. A group of men sat around a power strip, charging their phones, as though they were huddled around a campfire. Mahmoud had seen scenes like this everywhere along the route from Athens to Germany. He and his family paused just long enough to recharge their own phones again, and then they were on the move once more. Mahmoud was so tired he wanted to cry. His father found them a bus to Belgrade, and Mahmoud was thankful for the few hours' sleep, uncomfortable though they were. It was almost sundown when they arrived in the Serbian capital, but they still couldn't stop. The police there were raiding hotels for illegal refugees, so Dad found another taxi driver who promised to take them the 2 hours farther to the Hungarian border. Taxis were expensive, but so was trying to stay overnight in a city that didn't want you. The silver four-door Volkswagen was driven by a middle-aged, olive-skinned Serbian man with a neatly trimmed black beard. He promised to get them to Hungary and keep them away from the police for 30 euros apiece, more than it had cost them to cross all of Macedonia. It was a tight fit in the car, with Mahmoud, his mother, and his father crammed into the back seat, and Walid in his father's lap. This new driver seemed to find every rut and hole in the road and send them flying into each other. But none of that mattered to Mahmud. He was asleep almost as soon as he'd closed his eyes, and he only woke again when he realized the car wasn't moving. Had it really been 2 hours already? He felt like he'd just gone to sleep. Mahmud's eyelids fluttered, and he looked out the windows. He expected to see the lights of a Serbian border town, another tent city. Instead, they were stopped in the middle of a lonely stretch of highway surrounded by dark, empty fields. And the taxi driver was leaning over the back seat with a pistol aimed straight at them.
Joseph. Off the American coast, 1939. 21 days from home.
Miami! They weren't even a day out of Havana, and already the St. Louis was passing the American city. It was so close you could see it from the ship without binoculars. Joseph and Ruthie hung over the rails like everyone else, pointing out hotels and houses and parks. Joseph saw highways and white square office buildings, skyscrapers, and hundreds of little boats at harbor. Why couldn't they just pull into Miami and dock there? Why wouldn't the United States just let them in? There was so much land that didn't have buildings on it, miles and miles of palm trees and swamp as far as the eye could see. Joseph would take it. He would live there. He would live anywhere so long as it was away from the Nazis. An airplane circled the ship, its propeller buzzing like a hornet. Newspaper photographers, one of the other passengers guessed out loud. Joseph knew by now that the St. Louis was big news the world over. Newsreel camera crews had followed the ship out of Havana Harbor on little boats, yelling out the same questions all the passengers had. Where would they land? Who would take the Jewish refugees? Would they end up back in Germany? That afternoon, a U.S. Coast Guard cutter cruised alongside the St. Louis, its officers watching them through binoculars. One of the other children guessed the cutter was there to protect them, to pick up anyone who jumped overboard. Joseph thought it was to make sure the St. Louis didn't steer for Miami. Some of the children, like Ruthie, still played games and swam in the pool, and they were close enough to America for some of the teenagers to pick up a New York Yankees game on their radios. But most of the adults walked around like they were at a funeral. The happy mood of the voyage to Cuba was gone forever. People spoke little and socialized less. The movie theater was deserted. No one went to the dance hall, except for Joseph's mother. For days she had mourned Joseph's father, had become Joseph's father by locking herself in their cabin. But with the announcement that the St. Louis was leaving Cuba, leaving without her husband, something in her flipped like a light switch. She cleaned herself up, put on makeup, did her hair, dumped the contents of her suitcase on her bed, put on her favorite party dress, and went straight to the dance hall. She'd been there ever since. Joseph's mother was dancing by herself when he went to find her. A paper moon and stars still hung from the ceiling, decorations left over from the party when they all thought they'd be leaving the ship for Cuba. Joseph's mother saw him in the doorway and hurried over to him. She pulled Joseph with her onto the dance floor. "Dance with me, Joseph," she said. She took his hands in hers and led him in a waltz. "We didn't pay for all those dance lessons for nothing." The dance lessons had been a lifetime ago, back before Hitler. Back when his parents thought Joseph would be going to dances as a teenager, not running from the Nazis. "No," Joseph said. He was too old to dance with his mother, too embarrassed. And there were more important things to think about right now. "What's going on, Mama? Why are you doing this? It's like you're happy Papa's gone." She twirled in his arms. "Did I ever tell you why you're named Joseph?" she asked. No. "You're named after my older brother. I didn't know you had a brother." Joseph's mother danced like her life depended on it. "Joseph died in the Great War. My brother, Joseph, at the Battle of the Somme in France." Joseph didn't know what to say. His mother had never talked about her brother before. His uncle, he realized. He would have had an uncle. "You can live life as a ghost, waiting for death to come, or you can dance," she told him. "Do you understand?" "No," said Joseph.
The song ended, and Joseph's mother took his face in both her hands.
"You look just like him," she said.
Joseph didn't know what to say to that.
"I'm sorry for the interruption," the bandleader said, "but I've just been told there will be a special announcement in the A-Deck social hall."
Joseph's mother pouted because the music had stopped, but Joseph knew it was worse than that. He couldn't have said why, but he was sure, deep down in the pit of his stomach, that this would only be bad news. The worst. His mother took his hand and squeezed it.
"Come on," she said with a smile.
The social hall was already full when they got there. In the front of the room, under the giant portrait of Adolf Hitler, stood a committee of passengers who had been working with the captain on a solution to their problem. From the looks on their faces, they had not come up with one. When the head of the committee spoke, he confirmed all of Joseph's worst fears.
"The United States has refused us. We are heading back to Europe."
The outburst was instantaneous. Cries, gasps, tears. Joseph cursed, the first time he had ever cursed in front of his mother. She didn't react at all, and it made Joseph feel both a little ashamed and a little bolder at the same time.
"You mean we're going back to Germany?" someone yelled.
"Not necessarily," a committee member said, "but we must stay calm."
Calm? Joseph thought. Was the man insane?
"Calm? How can we stay calm?"
a man asked out loud, echoing Joseph's thoughts. The man's name was Posner. Joseph had seen him before on the ship.
"A lot of us were in concentration camps,"
Posner went on. His face was twisted in anger, and he spat his words.
"We were released only on condition that we leave Germany immediately. For us to return means one thing, going back to those camps. That could be the future of every man, woman, and child on this ship. We will not die. We won't return. We will not die," the crowd chanted.
Out of the corner of his eye, Joseph saw Otto Schindig lingering in the doorway. Schindig grinned at the panic in the room, and Joseph felt his blood begin to boil.
"Ladies and gentlemen," said the head of the committee, "the news is bad. That we all realize. But Europe is still many days away. That gives us and all our friends time to make new attempts to help us."
Joseph's mother pulled him away.
"Come, Joseph, somebody will think of something. Let's dance."
Joseph didn't understand why his mother wasn't upset, why she suddenly didn't seem to care anymore. They were about to be taken back to Germany, back to their deaths. Joseph let his mother pull him to the door, then broke away.
"No, Mama, I can't."
She smiled sadly at him and ducked past Otto Schindig, who leaned against the doorframe.
"You should do as your mother says, boy," Schindig said. "These are your last free days. Enjoy them. When you go back to Hamburg, nobody'll ever hear from you again."
Joseph went back to the yelling passengers, his anger rising like the tide. There had to be something they could do. Something he could do. The passenger who'd spoken up, Posner, pulled him aside.
"You are Aaron Landau's son, Joseph, yes? I'm sorry about your father," he said.
Joseph was tired of hearing people's condolences.
"Yes, thank you," he said, trying to move on.
The man grabbed his arm.
"You were among the children who went to the engine room and the bridge, yes?"
Joseph frowned. What was this about?
"And you're a man now. You had your bar mitzvah that first Shabbos on the ship."
Joseph stood taller, and the man let go of his arm.
"What of it?"
Joseph asked. The man looked around to make sure no one else was listening.
"There's a group of us who are going to try to storm the bridge and take hostages," he whispered. "Force the captain to run the ship aground on the American coast."
Joseph couldn't believe what he was hearing. He shook his head.
"It'll never work,"
Joseph said. He'd seen how many crew there really were on this ship, and what a lot of them below decks really thought about Jews. They wouldn't go down without a fight, and they knew this ship better than any passenger. Posner shrugged.
"What choice do we have? We can't go back. Your father knew that. That's why he did what he did. If we succeed, we're free. If we fail, at least the world will realize how desperate we are."
Joseph looked to the floor. If they failed, when they failed, the captain would take the ship back to Germany, and then Posner and the rest of the hijackers were sure to be sent to concentration camps.
"Why are you telling me this?" Joseph asked.
"Because we need you with us," Posner told him. "We need you to show us the way up to the bridge."
Isabel, off the coast of Florida, 1994. 5 days from home. Miami. It was like a dream. Like a glittering vision of heaven, as if Ivan had opened the gates for them. Everyone stared, stunned, as though they had never thought they would ever actually see it. When the lights on the horizon became the faint shapes of buildings and roads and trees, and they knew for sure they were looking at Miami, they cried and hugged each other again. Isabel cried again for Ivan, cried because he had been so close and hadn't made it. But her tears for him were mixed with relief that she would make it to the States. And that made her feel guilty and cry even harder. How could she be sad for Ivan and happy for herself at the same time? Crunk. Something bent and broke under Poppy's foot, and the boat lurched. Water streamed in from a new crack in the hull, and suddenly all feelings of relief ended. The boat was sinking.
"No!"
Poppy cried. He dove to try to shore up the hole, but there was nothing he could do. The weight of the ship and its passengers was pulling it apart at last. They all scrambled to the front of the boat, but the back end sank deeper and deeper under the weight of the heavy engine. The top of the hull was almost to the waterline at the back. When the two met, the ocean would flood in over the side and there would be no going back. They would drown. Or end up like Ivan. Terror rose in Isabel like the water filling the boat. She couldn't drown. Couldn't disappear beneath the waves like Lita. Like Ivan. No. No.
"Bail!"
her grandfather cried. Mommy was lying in the prow of the boat, as far away from the rising water as possible, her breath coming harder and shorter now. But everyone else dove for their cups and jugs. It wasn't going to be enough, though. Isabel could see that. There was too much water, too much weight. The engine. Isabel suddenly remembered the way it had been working itself loose from its bolts. She threw herself at it, trying to knock it loose. When she couldn't wrench it free by hand, she wedged herself in between it and the next bench, down in the water, and kicked at it with her feet.
"Chabela, leave the engine alone and help us bail," her father called.
Isabel ignored him and kicked. If she could just get the engine free, another foot joined hers. Amara. She understood. Together, they kicked at the engine until Isabel finally felt the wet wood around the bolts give. The engine tumbled to the bottom of the boat, covering up Fidel Castro's commandment to them. "Fight against the impossible and win," Isabel thought.
"One, two, three,"
Amara said. Together, she and Isabel rolled the motorcycle engine up the side and almost over, until Isabel slipped and it rolled back down with a splash into the water inside the boat.
"Again,"
Amara told her.
"One, two, three."
Up, up, up they rolled the engine and onto the top of the side where it pushed the hull down below the surface of the sea. Water gushed in, and Isabel felt the boat sinking under her feet, pulling her with it down into the black depths, down with Ivan and the sharks.
"No! Wait!"
Señor Castillo cried, and with one last good push, Isabel and Amara tipped the engine over the side. It slipped into the water with a slurp and dropped like a stone, and the back end of the boat shot back up out of the water, the weight of the engine no longer dragging it down.
"What have you done?"
Señor Castillo cried.
"Now we'll never make it to shore."
"We weren't going to make it if we sank,"
Amara told him.
"We'll row," Lito said. "When we're close enough in, the tide will take us the rest of the way. Or we'll swim."
Swim? Isabel worried. With the sharks?
Just bail or we won't be doing anything, Luis cried. Bail!
Bleep, bleep!
An electronic siren made them all jump, and a red swirling light came on a few hundred meters to their left. A person speaking English said something over a bullhorn. Isabel didn't understand. From the confused looks on everyone else's faces in the boat, they didn't either. Then the same voice repeated the message in Spanish.
Halt! This is the United States Coast Guard. You are in violation of U.S. waters. Remain where you are and prepare to be boarded.
Mahmoud, Serbia to Hungary, 2015. 15 to 16 days from home. Mahmoud stared at the gun pointed at him. Was this real, or was he still asleep and having a nightmare? The Serbian taxi driver waved the pistol at Mahmoud's family.
You pay 300 euros, he demanded.
This wasn't a dream. It was real. Mahmoud had been groggy just seconds before, but now he was wide awake, his heart hammering. His eyes felt dry, even though his shirt still clung to him with sleep sweat, and he blinked rapidly as he looked at his parents. They were already awake, his father hugging the still-sleeping Walid protectively.
"Don't shoot, please," Mahmoud's father said.
He threw one of his arms protectively across Mahmoud and his mother.
300 euros, the taxi driver said.
300 euros? That was more than twice what they had agreed to pay the driver.
Please, Dad begged. You not die, you pay 300,
the taxi driver yelled. His arm shook, and the gun danced between the two front seats. Mahmoud's mother closed her eyes and shrank away. Mahmoud's father threw up his hand.
We'll pay! We'll pay!
They were being held at gunpoint in the middle of nowhere in a foreign country. What else could he do? Mahmoud's heart thundered in his chest as his father handed Walid to Mom and fumbled with the money hidden inside his shirt under his belt. Mahmoud wanted to do something, to stop this man from threatening his family. But what could he do? Mahmoud was helpless, and that made him even madder. With shaking hands, Mahmoud's father counted out 300 euros and shoved them at the taxi driver. Why he didn't demand the whole stash of money, Mahmoud didn't understand.
You get out! Get out!
The taxi driver said. Mahmoud and his family didn't have to be told twice. They threw open the car doors and scrambled outside, and before the doors were even fully closed again, the Volkswagen tore off down the dark road, its red taillights disappearing around a curve. Mahmoud trembled with anger and fear, and his mother shook with quiet sobs. Mahmoud's father pulled them all into a hug.
Well, Mahmoud's father said at last, I'm definitely giving that driver a bad review on TripAdvisor.
Mahmoud's quivering legs gave out, and he sank to the ground. Tears streamed down his face as though they'd been held back by a dam before, and now the floodgates had suddenly been opened. He'd had a gun pointed right at his face. As long as he lived, Mahmoud would never forget that feeling of paralyzing terror, of powerlessness. His mother sat down in the road with him and hugged him. Mahmoud's tears came harder, fueled by everything that had come before. The bombing of their house, the attack on their car, struggling to live in Izmir, the long hours in the sea, and of course, Hannah, mostly Hannah.
I'm so sorry, Mom, Mahmoud blubbered. I'm so sorry I made you give Hannah away.
His mother stroked Mahmoud's hair and shook her head.
No, my beautiful boy. If the boat hadn't come along when it did, if you hadn't convinced them to take her, she would have drowned. I couldn't keep us above water. You saved her. I know you did. She's out there somewhere. We just have to find her.
Mahmoud nodded into his mother's shoulder.
I'll find her again, Mom. I promise.
Mahmoud and his mother cried and held each other, until Mahmud remembered they weren't getting any closer to Hana or to Germany. He dragged a sleeve across his wet mouth and nose, and his mother kissed him on the forehead.
"That thief took us about halfway to Hungary, at least," Mahmud's father said, looking at his phone. "We're on a back road, about an hour's drive from the border. I think we're close to a bus stop. It means we have to walk again, though."
Mahmud helped his mother stand, and his father hefted Walid up higher on his shoulder. Mahmud's little brother had slept through the whole thing. Mahmud worried again about his brother. Air raids, shootouts, taxi holdups, nothing seemed to faze him anymore. Was he just keeping all his tears and screams pent up inside, or was he becoming so used to horrible things happening all around him that he didn't notice anymore, didn't care? Would he come to life again when they got to Germany? If they got to Germany? They made it to the bus stop in time to catch the late bus to Horgos, a Serbian city on the Hungarian border. Even more Syrian refugees had collected there, but no one was getting through, not by road or rail, or even out in the countryside, the way Mahmud and his family had crossed into Macedonia and Serbia. The Hungarians had a fence. It wasn't finished yet, but even now, at night, Hungarian soldiers were hard at work driving 4-meter-tall metal poles into the ground along the border and stretching chain-link fencing between them. Once the fence was hung, another group came behind them and attached 3 tiers of razor wire coil to it to keep people from climbing over. The Hungarians were closing their border.
"But we don't even want to go to Hungary," Mahmud said. "We just want to get through to Austria."
"The Hungarians don't care, I guess," Dad said. "They don't want us in their country, whether we're coming or going."
A group of refugees suddenly rushed a part of the unfinished fence, trying to get through before it was done.
"We're not terrorists," someone cried. "We're refugees. We just want to get through to Germany. They